This is Mark Coatney, Deputy Managing Editor of Time.com. We're talking today with Time film critics Richard Corliss and Richard Schickel about their picks for the Time 100 movies list. Our question, first for Schickel and then for Corliss, is this. What are your criteria for picking what are the best 100 films of all time?
What I did was I just jotted down, and I didn't care how many. If I had 50 or 150, just movies I liked, you know. And even doing it that way, you know, you suddenly find you have stuff from Sweden, stuff from Japan, stuff from Germany, you know, from all the countries, actually. Obviously, it's more Americano-centric than it would be if I were a German critic, or an English critic, or particularly ethnocentric. But then I sort of, my priority was, well, let's see, you got an awful lot of X and not enough of Y, and gee, where's Z? You know, what became of that? I love that movie. And you know, you kind of, also what happens when you start making a list like that, you start free associating. You remember saying, oh, Cary Grant was in that, but oh, he was really good in that, you know, and you sort of, so then I suppose the final refinement is to say, and this is where we start back and forthing. We sort of say, well, gee, you know, gosh, there's not a Lubitsch film on here, and we both love Lubitsch. Or, I think at one point we didn't have a Sturgis on there in a very early stage, you know. So we start saying, well, wait, but these guys have got to be at least represented.
We started, each of us, composing a list of 100 films. And Dick did his first.
Yeah.
And to retain the purity of ignorance, I did not look at Dick's list when I composed mine. I had the feeling that Dick's was a little more drawing from directors onto films than mine was.
You mean more auteurist?
Yeah. Sure. And
probably was.
Although I was raised in that school, Dick being even more venerable than I, was a functioning critic before the word auteur was even applied to.
No, that's not true.
Film directors.
No, that's not true. Andy's had begun his auteurist work before I became a movie critic.
At Life in 1965.
When I became in 19, do we have to go into that, like hard dates? I mean, you know, they'll fire me for being the oldest fart in the block, you know.
Andrew Sarris, following the lead of and expanding on the work of French film critics, many of whom became directors, Truffaut, Godard, Romare, Chabrol, most of whom were writing for Cahiers du Cinéma, established a pantheon based on not films but directors. And that is probably the single most influential, not theory, but policy, mm-hmm. that convincing everyone, the lowliest critic at the Rocky Mountain Gazette, that the director is the author of the film, that it has been. Now, it happens that in my youth, I concentrated on screenwriters' work. And Andrew was kind enough to write the introduction to that, even though it was both an attack on and an act of slavish devotion toward his own work. But there, at the time, it seemed to me that yes, a director is the man who sets action and cut, and if he pays attention, he might be the person who frames the film, and sometimes he pays attention to the actors, but.
Lots of times.
The films of the Golden Age were, to a large extent, screenplays that were.
I agree with
that.
That
were well or poorly filmed.
But now we live in the age of lead. So I don't think that actually. I don't think, in a funny way, that's as applicable now as it was. Now, look, David Thompson has just written a book that essentially argues your point of view. You know, the movies he loves best are written movies by writers. And I'm toying with this theory. I don't think any of these movies, by the way, on our 100 list, but I'm toying with the theory the action, guys like Stanley Kubrick, on the one hand, and I hate to say this, George Lucas on the other, are really toying with the notion of, can you tell a story with minimal dialogue and lots of imagery, and then it becomes really the auteur's movie. I'm not saying that all of them, or maybe even any of them, have been fully successful in that, but I think auteurism has become now, in this new age, is actually a little more valid theory than when Andy first advanced it and Richard critiqued it. I just think that, you know...
That's because everyone realizes that the director is even more than ever in the seat of power.
Right.
George Lucas, whom Dick and I and two other Time staffers had lunch with last week, in the course of that hour and a half, must have said the phrase, "I'm a horrible writer," mm-hmm. four times.
That's right.
I was asking him, why didn't you hire a writer then to make right. the dialogue, if you think it's clunky?
As we say in Hollywood, come out and punch up the dialogue a little bit.
What,
punch up the script.
There were people who did that.
Yeah, there are people who still do it.
But the well-turned phrase, the beautiful screenplay, mm-hmm. is represented on this list by many films from the 30s, I would say, simply because most films of the 30s had a certain polish that we think of now. And I would say certainly Kind Hearts and Coronets is an example of a screenplay,
yeah.
elegant and epigrammatic in a way that normal,
but
naturalistic dialogue
what would
is not.
What do you say, though? I mean, just to... This I see this conversation going on for a couple hours now. Wouldn't you say, though, that there are certain exceptions to the rule? For example, I think Howard Hawks really directed those screenplays, really with great elan and with a great feeling for the language and for enhancing the language and making it sing and making the actors sing with it. And I think when you come to Sturgis, you know, you come to somebody who's actually writing his own scripts, and his actors are being directed to play his material in a particular way. I think Lubitsch is the same way. I think, you know, he worked very intensely with his writers to put in the Lubitsch touch, but those are elegant and wonderful.
He worked with some of the best writers, and
yeah,
Hawks
right.
worked with,
fair,
I guess
right.
Paul McHale mentioned, half of what you would consider Hawks is Jules Furstman and Ben Hecht.
Yeah.
The comment that sticks in my head is one from Bert Kennedy, who was a screenwriter of mostly of Westerns and became a director. And it was, I drove past Otto Preminger's house last night, or is it a house by Otto Preminger?
Yeah, it's a great
and
one.
The point being, if you occupy a work of art, have you become its begetter? Now, if you were to look at this list, you would say, Alfred E. Green and Norman Z. MacLeod are not in my pantheon, pal.
Yeah. But that applies then to the accidental nature of movies. That, you know, Alfred E. Green can make what I agree with Corliss is a magnificent film. You know,
Babyface,
and who's the other one you mentioned?
Norman Z. MacLeod, who directed It's a Gift.
A masterpiece, but he basically put the camera on John Fields, who was basically doing his own vaudeville routines. But, you know, he's right. You can't call that authorship. I mean, it's insane, you know.
For me, Babyface represents not just the free and rowdy spirit of what was called the pre-code years from 30 to 33, when strong women and mean guys were... Had a kind of urban sass that gave their films propulsion, even the direction was not necessarily of the highest quality.
Right.
But what it also represents for me is Warner Brothers in that period when Daryl Zanuck was running the place, when TNT began, as this was the Turner station, began in 1989, all of these films from the early 30s were shown, and that was one of the last revelations of a film not a genre, but this is a film period of a studio style that it's unquestionable that
absolutely.
Alfred E. Green and and William Wellman did his did his best work there, and the good directors did better, the bad directors did great. They had a certain energy. There was a distinct house style.
Yeah, and there were house. I mean, MGM had a house style. It was notably, to my taste, dull. I mean, you know, but it's very rich and elegant, and a lot of money was spent on Sidney Gilleroff's hairstyles and Adrian's gowns and all that stuff. But the movies never had the spunk of the Warner Brothers.
That's what I thought until I then saw the MGM films of the 30 to 33 period that Turner has. One of the curious things about this list that I didn't realize until we'd made it was how many of the so-called American films on the list, and I have to say, I had hoped to get a balance, a kind of 50-50 balance of the films that we finally chose. Again, Dick and I each chose 100. I started with the films that I always put on my 10 best list when I'm ever asked for them, and The Lady Eve has been on my 10 best list since
Absolutely.
The
60s. Right, yeah.
And His Girl Friday, too.
Yeah.
And both of us tend to prize comedy, I think, more highly than is typically rewarded, certainly in the Academy, and often in academic film histories. And Dick, for reasons of for generational or emotional reasons, tends to value film noir just a tiny bit more highly than I do.
I think that's true. I mean, film noir was when I was, you know, I mean, I have this theory I've expressed many places, which is the only movies that really count in memory are movies you see in their kind of impressionable years when, you know, when I was a kid, you're sort of 8 or 9. You could actually go to the neighborhood theater by yourself, or usually with a friend, and see these movies. And those movies made a huge impression on me. Yeah, sometimes I go back to them all the time and say, it's not so good. I mean, you know, I'm always doing that. But the ones that are good, interestingly enough, stay good. You know, the ones that you really loved when you were a kid. But sure, noir was huge for me. You know, I mean, I was... if you say sort of date noir from, I think Double Indemnity came out when I was 12. And so that's, wow. You know, I mean, it's still a huge impression that picture made on me. And before that, Casablanca, which is really in its way a film noir, you know, because of, you know, just in stylistic terms, which again presents the great test case of auteur, which is Michael Curtiz. You know, but he made an awful lot of really good movies.
Michael Curtiz was a good director.
Yeah, absolutely.
He just didn't have a theme.
Right.
Not the fallacy, but the facility of the auteur theory was to discover a theme. A theme was supposed to make a director more significant.
Right. Yeah.
Well, what that...
The theme, by which we use the word obsession. You know,
But... Since virtually all of the directors in the period we're talking about did not have control over what projects they got,
right?
If you got one director directed 25 years of Three Stooges comedies, there's got to be a theme there,
right?
But a theme doesn't make it. What is harder to define, and few critics have tried it, let alone succeeded. I think Dick Jameson was one of the few who did, was to talk about the way a movie looks. What is different about what this director does, and not in an academic way by saying there are lots of pans here, but to put into words mise en scène, which was the catchphrase of auteur criticism, which basically meant moving the camera. At any rate, I told you that I wanted to get as many non-American films on the list, and I guess I was a tad disappointed that maybe 55 of 100 are Hollywood films. But then I looked at this list, and just to run through a few titles from just of the Hollywood films, you tell me what they have in common. Sunrise, The Last Command, City Lights, Bride of Frankenstein, Dodsworth, Ninotchka, The Shop Around the Corner, Casablanca, Dick, anytime, Double Indemnity, Detour, Notorious, Out of the Past, A Streetcar Named Desire, On the Waterfront, and Some Like It Hot, and Psycho. Okay, but that which is the large majority of the Hollywood films, pre-1960 Hollywood films. They were all directed by foreigners.
Oh, really? How simple.
I mean, 2/3 of the pictures we chose were directed, American pictures were not directed by people born in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And even Ford was born in some Ireland of the...
I think he was actually born in Maine. But,
yeah, but you know. I mean, some part of Ireland that managed to float across the Atlantic.
Attach itself to Maine up there in the corner.
You know, Sean O. Figginshoe or whatever his name was. And anyway, when it came for my original 100, and I wouldn't mind at all if each of our long lists were published so you could see what we were trying to do individually before we got into
there's another, I think, sub-theme I haven't counted up, but think of how many, quite a few foreign films are actually derivative of American films.
That's what you find in the second, in the second, chronologically, the second half of the list.
Yeah.
I mean, what happened is that directors made Hollywood-style films in their home.
To say that
The Lord of the Rings is a New Zealand film.
Right. What is the sensibility of New Zealand?
It's kind of cheating. And then you have American directors who went elsewhere and made films. And I wouldn't surprise me if, just as some of our U.S. films were directed by Hitchcock, some of our English films were directed by Americans. I'm not sure.
Kubrick, for instance.
If Dr. Strangelove is considered British, if from the same year A Hard Day's Night is considered to be British.
Yeah. I don't know, do we have a Sandy McKendrick? Because he was technically an American who was...
He was an American who went to...
England
if
as a child.
If we'd had The Lady Killers, then that would fit. Perfect. We have Sweet Smell of Success. So what...
is... It's an international medium, but one dominated by the American sensibility. I mean, I think if you went through taking all these permutations we've just discussed, you would find that the American sensibility is dominant. I mean, there are noble exceptions. I mean, Ingmar Bergman would be one, you know, even we've got Truffaut's 400 Blows is, to my way of thinking, a kind of a variant with a childlike character on film noir. If you look at that movie, it's very noirishly lit, and it's very a dark, nighttime-y vision of Paris in a large measure. I mean, you know, this is...
So the French New Wave was largely inspired by pulp fiction. I mean, it was also the French who gave the phrase film noir.
Right.
As Jameson, whom I mentioned before, said, he's pretty sure that when Nick Ray ran into Jacques Tourneur on the RKO lot, one didn't say to the other, "Hey, I hear you're shooting a film noir today."
Right.
Because they didn't call them that. I guess they called them melodramas.
Now, film noir, I believe, this is the etymology of the word, is that after the war, and this is huge because, you know, in Nazi-occupied Europe, there were no American movies. So what happened in 1945 is the Americans reopened their offices and flooded Europe with 4 years or 5 years of movies that had been bottled up, and these kids from, you know, from the Cahiers crowd just ate them up. And, I mean, even the Godard on that film, you know, is a kind of a really interesting variant on a sort of American subgenre.
If we picked Breathless, that would have been even more
on
naked.
The money, yeah.
But if they weren't taking, actually what film noir came from, was
series noir.
What was Série Noire, which was a series of French translations of James
Raymond
M. Cain
and
Chandler novels.
Yeah.
And yes, they who were the age of the impressionable year. I will just say one of us at that period were smitten in the sense that they were smote by this
thing.
It was, and it would have been a little more obvious if you were getting all of these darker, gnarlier, bitch goddess films in one lump. So yes, they had. Noir continues on through this list and through Chinatown. Some would say The Fly. But, I mean, Blade Runner is a kind of noir.
Absolutely.
Brazil is a noir.
Just talking to Ridley about that the other day and how influential noir had been on making the look of Blade Runner.
Two things. When, for most of its history, say since the teens, since feature films became, since the 90-minute film became the norm, Hollywood films have been the most popular film in every country where there is they may be shown freely. With the possible exception of India, except I think there are some tax embargoes that don't make it. Each Hollywood film has to be subtitled or dubbed into every one of the 18 official languages.
Yeah.
But, and for a while, Hong Kong was the one place where people actually preferred their own films to Hollywood films. And there's a reason for that. They established the pace and the pulse of storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
They had beautiful people. There was just an assurance and a sexiness to the way the stories were told. Okay. And the art cinema was created in reaction to that. I mean, I know from going to film festivals that art films are to Hollywood films as baseball is to football. You know, they just don't have the pulse.
Right. Yeah.
And the images are often there for one to admire as one would a painting on the wall, and then after a few minutes you move to the next one. Now sometimes that can be beautiful filmmaking, and I think Robert Bresson was a pretty good example of a guy who pursued that. But the problem with Bresson, as with Godard, is that they established genres. They established formats that people then tried to follow who didn't have the intrinsic talent of those people.
I will say this, that when we finally got, I don't know about Richard did, but when we finally got down to the real nitty-gritty when we had 103 and all that stuff, I did start kind of re-examining, saying, well, wait a minute. I mean, that's when I think I made the pitch for the world of Apu, the Such a Dry film. I mean, it is a very beautiful family epic, and I actually probably was thinking about it because I just seen that new Italian family epic, which it's not entirely dissimilar. It's more melodramatic because it's Italian instead of Indian, but The Best of Youth. But this is fairly rare, but not entirely uncommon. These kind of lengthy things, and they tend not to be made in America. I guess maybe The Godfather is the exception.
Well, I would argue, I could argue that the three...
I love it when he's saucy.
Saucy but never sassy. That the three great monuments of 80s filmmaking were all films made for television. As The Best of Youth was.
Right.
It's a six-part, it's a masterpiece.
And if Rye was starting fresh today, believe me, he would be making that for Indian television, I bet you.
Yeah.
You know.
And just in case your listeners are wondering, that very debatable trio would be Fassbinder's Berlin-Alexanderplatz, which is 15 and a half hours and made for television. Kieslowski's Decalogue, which is 10... basically 55-minute films, and one that I didn't put on because it is essentially considered a television film, but I think it's as much film as television, The Singing Detective.
Mm-hmm. What we're saying there is that a kind of film that used to be made in the United States, and they weren't necessarily terribly successful movies or movies we even begin to think of for 100 best lists, but they were about mature people, with having mature people problems. I mean, I guess on the list you might put Double Indemnity. I mean, those are not kids, you know. But that was wildly popular. It was popular with me. It was popular Well, my parents probably didn't go to see it, but you know, but with grown-ups and you know, you could. There wasn't. Movies have become, in some ways, more enslaved demographics than the better television has been, I think. You know, we're talking HBO, we're talking oddities that come on other networks and so forth. But the American movies' absolute pursuit of, on the one hand, enormous action films, and on the other hand, you know, raunchy, stupid, except I kind of like some of the stupid teen comedies. I mean, there's a part of me that really... No, I didn't really consider Something About Mary for the best list, but it's a very enjoyable movie, as is Dumb and Dumber, which just happens to be one of Clint Eastwood's favorite. It's one of the things we share. Two stupid old gummers, you know, as he likes to call us, you know, who like this movie, you know. Fart jokes and all.
Well, if I can follow the difference between the one difference between the 40s, 30s, and 40s and now, is that The Lady Eve, Double Indemnity, Casablanca, Meet Me in St. Louis were all made for this general market. There was this market, and in 1946, the average, if you divided the number of moviegoers by the number of people in the United States, everyone was going to movies three times a week.
That's correct.
There were 4 billion, 4 billion tickets sold
annually.
Yes.
Yeah.
And now there are about a billion and a half, something like that.
No, I mean what?
And everybody, and they had a fairly wide range of.
But there's something depressing in what you just said, because they had the demographics of television, but television hasn't lived up to those demographics, I suppose, in the same way that the movies of the period Richard just mentioned, the 30s, 40s, early 50s, did.
I'm tempted to say, because I wasn't there exactly, that movies were smarter than Americans, in a way.
Well, let's put it this way. Americans were smarter than them.
There's a line in The Awful Truth, and I never get these two cities straight, but maybe you can help me, where suave Cary Grant could lose his estranged wife, Irene Dunne, to yokel, to
Ralph Bellamy,
who's from Oklahoma.
Yeah.
And they're going to move to Oklahoma City, I think. And Carrie brightly says, oh, what a wonderful social life you'll have. And if you get bored, you can go over to Tulsa. And even when I saw this as a kid, I thought, well, who are the people in Tulsa think of this? Who can make fun of this?
There's a great line in Sturgis's Hollywood movie, Sullivan's Travels, where they're discussing with Sullivan his movies. And they say, it died like a dog in this place and that place. Pittsburgh. He says, you know, but they loved it in Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh? He said, they know what they like in Pittsburgh. He says, if they knew what they like, they wouldn't live in Pittsburgh.
So you would think that...
That's right there in a movie. Today, I mean, I was just having breakfast yesterday with a guy who's trying to put on a movie, this sort of CI and Navy thriller deal, and showing it to the 30-year-old development girl, and there's a line in it where the captain of the ship says, "Sound general quarters," and she says, "Now wait a minute, I have a note here." She says, "You've never introduced this character, general quarters, before."
You know, occasionally we get a note from an editor, a top editor, when we have said something we think is understandable to all,
right?
And the editor will say, "I don't get this. Am I just being stupid?" And the writer once went, "Yes." But I realized even as a kid that everything I knew, I thought was crucial to know, and anyone who didn't know this little bit of information was ignorant.
Right.
And everything I didn't know wasn't worth knowing, and everyone who did know those things was a fop.
Yeah, right.
But there was an assumption, I think there was an assumption that people would rise to the level of the movie. And these and Sturgis and McCary were not trying.
And nobody, as far as I know, no one gave them notes and said, you know, you can't say that about Pittsburgh. We do quite a bit of business in Pittsburgh. You know, I mean,
we hear endless stories about how Irving Thalberg at MGM had endings changed and so forth. And there are certainly memos from Hal Wallace and Jack Warner that showed they were very and Selznick, famously, notoriously, very involved with every hem stitch on the gown.
But here's an interesting,
well, it's every word.
But an interesting point is, I've never. This would be a great PhD thesis for some. There was a lot of Yiddishkeit in American movies in the 30s, just as there came to be in American television, starting I guess in the late 50s, the 60s, and. But that all disappeared from the movies. I mean, because that assumption of, well, everybody's heard that word. I mean, there's a famous scene, I think it's in Taxi, but Cagney just starts talking Yiddish to another taxi driver standing around at their taxi stand. It, as it happened, Cagney had grown up in a Jewish neighborhood. He had a lot of Yiddish at his command. You know? So he just thought that would be a funny thing to put in, you know. And I think the assumption that, that Richard is talking about, the movies... He alluded to the pre-code movies, and it's absolutely true. Those movies, just made today with the same script, different actors, would be outrageous to the moralists of this country and what we're doing to our youth and so forth. I mean, Babyface is about a woman sleeping her way to the top of the bank. I don't forget how many guys she sleeps with in the course of the movie, but seven or eight at least as she rises from the head cashier to the chairman of the board. I mean, it's great, and it's just an assumption. Well, some women are like that, you know. We aren't making a moral judgment. We're telling a story that actually is, has some psychological truth to it, if you think about it. I think there's a little bit of... I kind of wanted to have some... I think we're both in revolt against, you know, the Sight and Sound 10 best list, which incidentally also as that group ages, you know, the silent films drop out, now the early 30s films are dropping out because they're not the impressionable years of the majority of the voters. But I really thought there's certain movies, I think maybe Meet Me in St. Louis is a good example for me. I loved that movie as a kid. I went back to it as a grown-up at various stages, each time kind of reveling in how much darker it was than I perceived it as, a, say, a 10-year-old seeing it for the first time. It was just a jolly movie. And, you know, it's a kind of an official movie, but I love Vincent Minnelli. I think he was really a great movie artist and a test case, in a way, for authorship because he would take these scripts and he would, you know, order up whatever, you know, weird stuff he wanted to put in that movie and they would all, and he was sort of an inarticulate man, so he was kind of like, you know, groping for the words to tell the art director what he wanted and all that stuff. But I think that, you know, some of those movies that, you know, we tend to ignore, if you're serious about movies, how can they be any good? I mean, there's people in there that won Academy Awards. But I wanted a few of those on there because I think some of them are terrific, you know, just as movies.
And I wanted to speak to the... Well, I guess maybe it was the United Nations impulse in me. I mean, Dick is, even in the films that we review, partly because I spend more time at film festivals and haunting disreputable video stores, though not the kind you're thinking, in New York's Chinatown and Little India. But seeing Indian popular films, I'm happy the Apu trilogy is on here, but I'm happy as well that a couple examples of Indian film musicals, we would say, over the of the last two of the last 50 years, are represented here. That is the one industry that, in bulk, I don't say in quality necessarily, can match the United States. Yes, I wanted an Iranian film. Yes, I wanted a film from Latin America, and On a list such as this, and yes, there are a few Chinese films, and I think Japan is probably also well represented from its peak period in the 50s.
Yeah, right. I think.
But that's more auteur than nationality, don't you think?
Yeah, it's Ozu and Kurosawa for sure.
Yeah, But if you see our, if our original hundreds are put on there, and actually there are some we came up with much later and said, how could we not have included this?
Right.
I think you will find that there are significant differences between not just the kinds of films that Dick and I like, but the films we like within the same kind.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as you look at the list that we finally came up with, a kind of amity and respect for each other's differences that...
Excepting, of course, The Fly.
And you will just have to read my comment to understand how poignant and profound a human drama that is. Not to mention it's kind of film noir.